welcome to the second half of We the People Radio on March 20th, 2022. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape has everything to do with John Deere. If you need tractors or mowers or attachments, need your tractor worked on or just need to buy some parts for it, go up and see them. They've got a great inventory. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call. Our phone number is 226-9226, or catch them on the web at Pape Machinery. That's spelled P-A-P-E, machinery.com. There you have it.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
So, we are chatting with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about, the Ukraine thing. And this will be the version that you don't get through the mainstream media because they're, I don't know, they seem to only have one message these days. There's not a lot of variety.
War.
Yeah. We better get over there and do it because otherwise we're not nice.
It's our duty.
Hey, Dr. Pry, before we get back to the nuclear part of it, which is super important, but we were talking during the break, and Bill's first comment when we paused there was, yep, and no matter what happens, we're going to wind up having to go rebuild it because we got in too late and now we owe them. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that will probably be the administration's position if they stay in power. If the Russians don't take Ukraine over, that's the one scenario where we won't have to go and rebuild it.
That'll save us some money.
And I still think it's the most likely scenario for reasons I'll explain later. But I'm disappointed in myself that I've let half the show go by, and I still haven't told you the most important thing I wanted to tell your audience.
Oh.
And that is, you know, the message of the article I wrote, you know, which is the nuclear 9/11 in our future, that right now, I think that we're facing the greatest nuclear crisis, a more serious nuclear crisis than the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this is more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because Washington doesn't believe has this ideology of arms control that dominates their worldview and their threat perception, that they find it so hard to understand the adversary military doctrine, the adversary worldview, that yes, you can fight and win a nuclear war, and we're prepared to do it. They just can't bring themselves to believe that. We've been so trained in our side, in the West, to think that nuclear war is unthinkable, that they will come up with, and so indoctrinated to fear it as the apocalypse, that they will engage in denial behavior, to deny evidence, plain evidence, right in front of their faces about the elevated nuclear threat. It's not just Lindsey Graham is an idiot. He's just one of the foremost and most vociferous examples. But official Washington, the people who are supposed to be smart, on these issues, are also so biased and blind that they will not be able to provide warning to our political and military leaders, not even warning, you know, when a surprise attack may occur or actually does occur. And I say that because of what happened on March 8th, where America's top intelligence officer, our top spy, a lady named Avril Haines, testified to Congress, basically, don't worry about all those nuclear threats from Putin. He's saber-rattling, he's bluffing. She admits that it's extraordinary what he has said and his allegation that he put his forces on high alert, but she claims that we don't have to worry because the intelligence community has been watching Russia's strategic forces like a hawk, and they don't see any evidence of the ballistic missile submarines putting to sea, or the bombers being mobilized, or the mobile ICBMs going to field. And therefore, all these indicators suggest that Russia's strategic forces are not more ready than normal to make a nuclear attack. They're not mobilizing to make a nuclear attack. So Putin is just bluffing. And all of that is either a lie, or we're even worse off than if they're lying. Our intelligence community has become so incompetent that they have forgotten, you know, how Russia is prepared for a nuclear war and surprise nuclear attack. And if I could just go through some of these technical issues.
Yeah, please.
You know, because when I worked for the CIA, one of my jobs was I was a senior analyst with the National Intelligence Officer for Strategic Warning, and I worked on paradigms for warning about a nuclear war. When it might happen? What do we look for? What can't we see? And I actually got a special award, a unique award, the only time it had ever been given. When I left CIA to work for Congress, praising me for my work on these paradigms. And I guess I don't deserve that award because it's obviously my work obviously didn't penetrate the brain of the people who are still there in the intelligence community. You know, let's go through this. Intelligence and warning indicators of nuclear war 101. All right, a basic course. One of the most fundamental things is there a major war in Europe involving the nuclear superpowers? That's one of the big indicators where you should be very concerned about an elevated threat of nuclear war. And it's actually happening. But I guess DNI Haynes doesn't count that anymore. You know, that for some reason, is not regarded as an indicator. Next, has the National Command Authority, and that is Dictator Putin, I mean, he is the National Command Authority for Russia, has he declared a heightened alert of his forces? And he has. Maybe it's a lie. Strange that he would be lying, but he has declared it. You know, is there reason we should believe it? Keeping in mind, by the way, I, and in defense of the intelligence community, also testifying to Congress was the General Berryer, who is the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now, he's not the top spy. DIA is one of, you know, a dozen of the intelligence agencies, but it's one of the biggest. And he did say, you know, when Vladimir Putin makes nuclear threats, we have to take him very, very seriously. Now, that's a common sense thing, you know. To assume the man is lying is extremely irresponsible, especially when you're talking about the defense and intelligence community that are charged with protecting America and the American people from a nuclear war. To just blow it off and say, oh, I don't believe him, so don't worry about it.
That makes no sense.
Right. This is like, to put it down into more understandable human terms, suppose you had a neighbor, you know, who was an outpatient from, a mental institution with a history of a violent criminal past, and you hear this guy shooting off his guns in his backyard all the time, and he takes a dislike to you, and he threatens to shoot you, and you call the cops. And the reaction of the police is, I don't even want to talk to him. Don't worry about it. He's just bluffing. I mean, that's exactly the scenario we're in.
Yep.
You know, where Russia's got a nuclear gun pointed at us, and the people that are supposed to protect us are saying, don't worry about it. He's just bluffing. You know, now, if we go through these so-called... the reason it may be incompetent is there's a phenomenon called mirror imaging, you know, that happens when you assume that the other side has to do what you would do. In order to mobilize our forces for a nuclear war, for example, you know, we would have to send our ballistic missile submarines to sea because they have intermediate range ballistic missiles, and they have to go to sea in order to reach Russia. And we, you know, most of our weapons are on ballistic missile submarines and bombers, so we also have to mobilize our bomber force. And we have a lot of people in the intelligence community who have served in the bomber service and in the and the submarine service. And so they too would advise Avril Haines to probably think, well, the Russians, you know, do it the way we do. But they don't. Russia has a completely different strategic culture from ours. You know, they have been subject to surprise attacks and invasions throughout their history. And this bloody history has made them cautious to the point of paranoia. We would call it paranoia. They are rational actors, but they are very differently rational than we are because they have a very different history where they have been victims of surprise attacks. Most recently, for example, is Operation Barbarossa, which is a massive surprise attack launched on them by Nazi Germany in World War II that very nearly succeeded in destroying the Soviet Union. And that and the other part of their history has conditioned them to say, we're never going to let that happen again. If there's ever another war, it's not going to be fought on our territory, and we're going to be the ones making the surprise attack. We will be the first ones to strike. That's where they're coming from. And they have postured their strategic forces to do exactly that. So they rely much more heavily on ICBMs. The ICBMs are the smallest part of our triad. They carry the fewest warheads. And our triad is not designed for surprise attack. It's basically a long arms control philosophy. It's designed for what arms controllers call strategic stability and transparency. Arms control people like the fact that we have to send our submarines to sea, because that way we can politically signal, we can use our strategic forces to signal to the Russians that we're worried about something they're doing, and so we're going to send our subs to sea as a warning. And also, when our submarines are not at sea, they can see our submarines are still at port, and so they don't have to worry about a surprise attack. Same thing with the bombers. That we have to mobilize the bombers. That would be very visible. In fact, it takes 3 days for us to mobilize our bombers. And the arms control community likes that. You know, they think that's a good thing. You know, from a Russian perspective, they don't want to be in a position where they have to mobilize stuff and it's going to be seen, because it gives the adversary a chance to beat them to the draw and make the surprise attack first. So they rely very heavily on ICBMs and are MIRVed ICBMs. So their ICBMs carry more than one warhead. Like their, you know, best ICBM, the FS-18, you know, carries 10 warheads. Our ICBMs only carry one warhead because we don't want to be in a position to make a surprise attack. You know, that's destabilizing in arms control theory. So therefore, the ICBMs, the Russian ICBMs have command and control arrangements, and they're in a condition every day called constant combat readiness. So over 95% of them are ready to launch on 3 minutes' notice, and they have command and control arrangements for their ICBMs, so they can do this in secret. You know, what about those mobile ICBMs? Don't they have to go to the field, like Avril Haines said? No, they don't. You know, the garages for their mobile ICBMs, they have retractable roofs, so they don't have to send ICBMs to the field or increase it. They always have some in the field, but they don't have to increase the numbers. They can launch them right from the garages. And the guys in the field, there are cables out there in the field, so they can connect into those cables, so they can get secret commands to launch the ICBMs in the field. Even Russia's submarines carry intercontinental ballistic missiles. You know, unlike our submarines, which have to go to sea because they have intermediate-range missiles, their submarines can strike the United States right from port. They don't have to go to sea.
What does that mean, intermediate? How close do they have to be?
Well, an intermediate-range missile has a range under about 5,000 kilometers, you know, so that we would have to send our submarines out, you know, at least to the mid-Pacific, to the mid-Atlantic, you know, to be in a position
right.
to strike Russia. They don't have to do that. They can launch their submarine missiles right from port, and they have command and control. They're wired so they can execute them, just as if they're silo-based ICBMs. Even the submarines, the Russian submarines that are at sea, don't need to get emergency action messages the way we would do it. In order to send launch orders to our submarines, you know, we would send out what are called TACAMO aircraft. They're mostly based at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. So they have to fly from Oklahoma out to the Atlantic, you know, roughly where the patrol area of our submarines are, and out to the Pacific, and then they put down a big trailing wire, you know, to send very low frequency signals to the submarine. It's called a bell ringer to say, we have orders from you, urgent orders. You know, you have to come close to the surface and put up an antenna to receive those orders. Anyway, it's a complicated process that takes hours to do. You know, this is not the case with the Russian submarine. They got to be ordered to do it secretly with their command and control arrangements, and even their submarines at sea. Unlike our submarine, the Russians do send their ballistic missile submarines out to patrols in the Atlantic and Pacific sometimes, but most of the times they don't. Most of the times they're either aboard or they're in what are called bastion areas, the White Sea or the Sea of Okhotsk. These are seas that are very close to the borders of Russia, and so the Navy can protect them. You know, they're afraid that we would try to sink their ballistic missile submarine if they were out in the deep ocean with our attack submarines as part of a surprise attack. So they protect those submarines, and they they have cables on the bottom of the ocean in the White Sea and the Sea of Okhotsk. So even the seaborne, the submarines at sea, they don't need to send air TACAMOs out, which is a very visible thing, you know, that they would, the way we would do it. You know, the submarines can connect to those undersea cables, and DNI Haynes and nobody on our side would ever know it. So basically, all of the Russian intercontinental ballistic missile force, which is all their ICBMs, all their ballistic missile submarine warheads, that's most of their weapons. The least important part of the Russian triad is their bombers.
Okay, hold that thought, Dr. Pry. I knew we had to take a break. I was just trying to find a logical spot. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. We are talking with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. To the king of the road. How's the drive going, by the way?
Very well. You know, one of the reasons I like the people, it makes the time go by more quickly.
Yeah, might as well chit-chat about nuclear war while you're, you know, headed to Florida.
it's better than listening to NPR.
Absolutely. Thanks for that.
Also a transgender revolution.
Yeah, who knows what else they may come up with today. And, that's not going to help your driving abilities. Oh, what a bunch of lunatics. Bill had a question for you, though, before we moved on.
Yeah, on your Newsmax article, you had made the comment... If they did make a first strike, our ability to make a second strike may not be there. Elaborate.
Well, that's
on
right. It. Sure. You know, the first thing they're going to do is hit us with an EMP. That's going to paralyze our command and control capabilities, and it could paralyze the nuclear forces themselves that are on the continental United States. Even the small number of ballistic missile submarines that we have on patrol at sea, we normally have about four, two in the Atlantic, two in the Pacific, may be rendered useless because the captains have to get unlocking codes, and it's off. need to know what target they're shooting at.
Right.
And they need to be able to unlock the weapons themselves and the missiles to launch them. And if they can't get EAM, then those submarines are basically, it's called a system kill. The submarine and the crew will still be alive, but if it can't operate, it's as good as dead as far as the war is concerned. So just with the EMP attack alone, and they have super EMP weapons. We don't. You know, they might win the war that way. But the Russians, of course, being very conservative military planners, they might not be happy to hit us with just the EMP. You know, they've got, that's why they have the SS-18, for example, which alone, just using that missile, is enough to deliver the 500 highly accurate warheads that would destroy our ICBM silos, the three bomber bases, the two ballistic missile submarine ports where most of our boats and a few of the command and control centers like Tinker Air Force Base that I mentioned and Peterson Air Force Base, you know, which is where Space Command and NORAD are located. So that they would destroy, it's called a counterforce attack. They would destroy our military forces and the command control capabilities to coordinate and execute those forces.
Sure.
And win a nuclear war that way.
Right.
I mean, you know, and it would entail, as time goes on, but right now it would entail very few casualties, which is one of the other things that makes it attractive from their perspective, you know, because if their attack did fail, you know, they're not attacking major cities, they're not inflicting, you know, mass destruction of the population, and therefore it wouldn't make sense for us, if their attack failed, to retaliate against their cities. You know, we would have tried to do counterforce attacks back at them, and we're not really as well equipped to do that. Our forces are not designed for that as well as the Russian forces are. So it's the temptation to do it could be very high, you know, because of the payoff. Back in 1975, Jim Schlesinger, who was a friend of mine, gone now, but he's the only man who was both the Secretary of Defense and the Director of the CIA. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy. But when he was Secretary of Defense, using 1975-era nuclear weapons, he did it. The Department of Defense did exchange models and calculations about what would the U.S. Deaths be, casualties be, from a nuclear war where the Russians did a first strike, a disarming first strike against our bombers and ICBM and submarines and ports. And that's when we had many more ICBMs. We had over 1,000 ICBMs in those days. We had only got 400 today. And we had many more bomber bases. We've only got 3 bomber bases today. Back then, we had 45 bomber bases. And doing all of that, the Defense Department calculated it would inflict 2 million dead in the United States. You know, that's, you know, less than 1% of the population.
Right.
Oh, those are horrific losses, right? But it's not the end of the United States as a civilization. We would have very great incentive not to hit their cities. You know, we would try to do what we could against their forces in such an exchange. But because they struck first, that's why they've got things like mobile ICBM. You know, their silos-based missiles would already be launched. So we'd be hitting empty silos. Their bombers would have been moved out so that we would be hitting empty bomber bases. Their ballistic missile submarines would probably have participated. So the submarines would either be empty or they'd be going to sea. So the guy who goes first has got tremendous strategic advantages. And that was 1975. You know, Russian weapons, modern weapons today, you know, they're 55 years more advanced than they were in 1975. You know, they're much more accurate. They can use lower yields. They've got warheads of new design that can produce little or no fallout. So so the collateral damage they would have to inflict on the civilian population, on the non-combatants, it would probably be much less today. But it would certainly be much less today. Therefore, the incentive for them, the temptation to do it, goes way up. And that's why when idiot Lindsey Graham, you know, and not just idiot Lindsey Graham, I don't want to focus at all on him, but the bigger failure is our own intelligence community. you know, lying to the American people about the risk of a nuclear war. And I think they're covering up. I hope they're covering up. I hope they're not so ignorant, you know, that they have forgotten the basics about how the Russians can execute a surprise attack. And but I think they're covering up because they don't want, because the Biden administration doesn't want another something far worse than Afghanistan, the Afghanistan debacle. You know,
yeah.
Don't want to admit, look at my policies in Ukraine have brought us to the verge of a nuclear war, and now I don't know what to do. I mean, that's basically where we are.
Right.
And you know, and that is a real politically damaging thing to have to admit. So there's an enormous. So Avril Haines, who is his handpicked, Biden's handpicked director of national intelligence, you know, obviously doesn't want to put her boss in an unflattering light, and that's why we're. But it's not. It's worse than that. We're not just being lied to, but to make the lie credible, they have not raised the readiness level of our strategic forces. You know, we have 5 readiness levels: DEFCON 5, which is the lowest readiness level, to DEFCON 1, which is the highest readiness for this level. And in the past, whenever the Russians, when we have known them, when they've been making overt nuclear threats and doing things that make that threat credible, in the past what we have done is raise the level of our forces, raise the DEFCON level, to posture our forces in a more survivable way so they're not so vulnerable to a first strike, to a surprise attack. That's what Kennedy did, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He went all the way up to DEFCON 2, which is just short of a nuclear war. And it worked. You know, it got Khrushchev to back off and take the missiles out of Cuba and, you know, and resolve the confrontation peacefully. It helped that we had a 5-to-1 superiority in ICBMs back then. But to leave our forces unmobilized and at DEFCON 5, I mean, you know, it's inviting a nuclear Pearl Harbor, or what I, as I term it in the article, a nuclear 9/11, and could add another spectacular intelligence failure to the long list of intelligence failures that our intelligence community committed to in the course of its history and in recent days, as recently as Afghanistan, in terms of getting things wrong. So, you know, the American people are either being lied to, or the intelligence community is so incompetent that they don't recognize the threat. I think it's the former. I think we're being lied to, and that we're really in the middle of something that's graver than the Cuban Missile Crisis. And why is that? Why is it worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis? Because we haven't increased the DEFCON level. You know, the other side is almost certainly ready for a surprise attack if things go so badly that they feel that they need to do that, and we are exposed to that. We are postured so that a surprise attack would succeed and be rewarded if they were to do it. Thanks, because Joe Biden doesn't want to admit that he's got us into a situation that's far worse than his Afghanistan debacle, and it's all being done for political reasons. You know, they want to win the midterms.
Right.
They don't want another political embarrassment. American national security be damned. You know, that's where we are. It's even worse than what I've been telling you. You know, I didn't even put this into the article. But maybe I should have. But these calls to assassinate Putin that are going on.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about
from
that.
Republicans.
Yeah.
These people, they have, you know, and it shows the ignorance of our political leadership class. They're so, and of our intelligence community too. The Biden administration should have put a stop to that kind of talk. You know, because the Russians have got a system called dead hand. That's what we call it. It's actually called perimeter. You know, this is a doomsday machine. So that if the National Command Authority is killed, they can switch. They switch this thing on in advance, and maybe they have. We don't know whether they've done it or not. This might be the special nuclear alert that Putin was talking about, or part of it. You switch on the dead hand, and if the political leadership is killed, it will automatically launch a retaliatory strike. In this case, it would be a first strike because we're not making a nuclear attack.
Sure.
But it would strike all of Russia's enemies. It would make nuclear attacks to a plague upon everybody's house and destroy everybody.
Gosh, yeah, they haven't mentioned that. They've specifically neglected to bring that up.
Yeah, a little oversight there about what could happen if you assassinate Putin. You know, that's what you could happen. Bring on the very nuclear war that Lindsey Graham claims will never happen.
Do you think by raising do you think by raising the DEFCON level would alert them and cause them to react?
It could. I'm not saying that's without risk, but judging who we're dealing with, Putin. And I don't want people to get the false impression. Tucker Carlson, for example, is always getting criticized as being, a Russian agent or a fan of Putin.
I'm sure we are now too.
Those of us who are criticizing the administration's policies and are saying it is not worth the risk getting us involved in the war of Ukraine. It is that we have no vital strategic interest in Ukraine. It is not worth risking the American people for Ukraine. We are not Russian sympathizers. We are not on the side of Putin. I think Putin is evil. I think he's a dictator. He's a killer, former KGB thug. And for that very reason, there is no really safe thing to do. But judging historically, what we've done in the past, I think the most dangerous thing is believe yourself vulnerable to a killer.
Appealing to them with humanitarian, the humanitarian appeal is just stupid. We have to take a really quick break, but I did want to draw people's attention to the website today on March 20th, 2022, at We the People. We have the article, and it's Dr. Price's exact message was it's a shorter version of the article that will be published in Newsmax behind a paywall on Monday as Biden blunders toward nuclear war. He's added some analysis recommendations and I'm providing an advanced copy with extra information, and that is on our website. You can just click on it. There's also a downloadable Word file with that on there, so I would encourage you to go read that. The spoiler alert, it explains all the DEFCON stuff and all that. So for people that are kind of going, I don't even know what this is all about. Is this scary or bad or what are we talking? Yeah, go read about it. It's interesting, and please send it to a friend. We will be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I tell you what I'd do, I'd go downtown, buy a Mercury or two. Crazy about a Mercury, Lord, I'm crazy about a Mercury. I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road. I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road. Yeah, I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road.
We return to the highway with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
We have so little time left, and I'm afraid I've wasted so much of your time because there was so much more I wanted to say. Let me just try to compress it.
It's okay. There's always another week.
Okay. First I wanted to finish answering Bill's question about if we mobilized our forces now, could that result in the Russians deciding to strike us? And it is a risk, yeah. That is a risk. It should have been done immediately when the Russians started announced the mobilization of their forces. We should have done the same when they were doing it. Now that they're mobilized, we don't know to what level, but we know that their ICBMs are always ready to go. So, yeah, it's risky to do it, but in my judgment, it's even riskier to to leave our forces unmobilized at DEFCON 5, you know, because we don't know what's going to happen in Ukraine. They might decide, okay, the stupid Americans have exposed their neck to us. Let's take advantage of it, especially with all this talk about destroying Russia, fomenting a revolution in Russia to topple their elite, assassinating Putin and all of that. I'm no fan of the Russian regime, but I am a fan of America and the American people, and I don't want us getting killed by such imprudent, the threats and fantasies, too. About, for example, that was one of Lindsey Graham's ideas. Well, Lindsey, they don't have a Second Amendment in Russia. You know, you would be sending thousands of Russians to their deaths against the armed MVD and army that would defend that regime. Or if we succeeded in fomenting a revolution in Russia, they would probably launch a nuclear strike to take us down, too. The short answer is, we've got to... I don't think we should ever leave ourselves vulnerable to a surprise attack. We need to move our forces to a more survivable posture. But we should also communicate that to Putin, you know, through our embassy and say, look, you have put your forces on a higher alert. You leave us no other alternative but to do the same. Please bring your forces down so we can bring our forces down. And in fact, we could even use that as a basis for trying to negotiate an end to all the killing and say, you know, look at, you know, this issue for both of our countries, you know, is raised the risk of a nuclear war. What is it going to take, you know, to end this thing? And it could give us a basis for going back to negotiating the peace treaty that the Russians originally offered that we had talked about on your previous show. And it wasn't the demands they had in that peace treaty were not unreasonable. A lot of the terms were even more in our interest than they were in the Russian interest. Another point I want to make, because a lot of people are going to say, just like Lindsey Graham, well, look at, why can't we, shouldn't we cover ourselves with glory? The Ukrainians are winning the war. And, you know, let's go teach Russia a lesson and beat up on the Russians and destroy the Russian army in Ukraine. We don't know what's happening in Ukraine. Everything we're hearing is coming from the Ukrainian government, which has got an interest in trying to exaggerate their victories, if they have actually had the victory, many lies they've told. And also from the Biden administration, which has a political interest in trying to make it look like the Russian invasion has backfired and is stalled and is not going to succeed, because they want to distract attention from the fact that Biden sacrificed America's credibility, you know, when he drew a line in the sand over Ukraine and Russian tanks rolled right over it. You know, they would rather have the conversation about how bad the Russians are doing. It's true that the Russians are doing badly in Ukraine. I'm just saying that we don't know. The fog of war is too thick. Look at what we were told by our own intelligence people and our own army about how well things were supposed to be going in Afghanistan, right? We had our own army involved and our own intelligence people. We weren't having to believe the Ukrainians or an independent source or a politically biased administration. So we're not going to really know until after the Ukraine war is over. And it may be long after it's over what the real truth is about what happened on the ground and what's happening on the ground. And I'm going to offer a scenario here in the last, you know, I know we're almost out of time here, but...
That's good. We have like 10 minutes.
This is just for something for you to think about. Just for something to think about. And I'm not saying that this is the situation. I'm saying we don't know what the situation is. But, you know, the Russians are great. The Russian general staff, they're great students of military history. Unlike our West Point and Annapolis, unfortunately, where we don't study military history as much as we should. I keep thinking about the Battle of Austerlitz, one of the 21 decisive battles of the world. It was Napoleon's greatest victory. It was a victory over the Russians, the combined force of the Russians, the Austrians, and the Prussians. It gave Napoleon control of Europe for a decade after his victory. And he achieved this victory by a great deception. He deliberately took the part of the battlefield that was least advantageous to him geographically. And he convinced his adversaries that the French army was on the ropes, that its morale was very low, that it was on the verge of disintegration. He had regiments run away, an apparent cowardice from the Russians. And all of this was designed to lure the Russians and the Austrians into attacking. You know, he had built up secretly a big reserve of forces that then crushed them. They came down and tried to attack. Is it possible? I'm not saying that this is so, but, you know, because the fog of war covers the battlefield. But we should at least entertain the possibility that if we did jump into the Ukraine war, that all of the intelligence we're being given about how badly the Russians are doing turns out to be wrong. You know, maybe they're playing a battle of Austerlitz strategy here. Is it possible they want us to intervene in Ukraine so they could then use their vast superiority in tactical nuclear weapons to solve the NATO problem forever? Just a thought.
Mm. Yeah. No, it's very, you know, I've always thought it's odd to me that a country like Russia with an army the size that it has goes into Ukraine and stumbles and can't get a real good footing and is being held off by a totally inferior.
Yes, and how it's lasted this long?
Yeah, well, they're up against an inferior opponent, and I had a hard time believing that they were that ill prepared when they went in. I mean, it didn't look right to me either. So I don't know. You might be onto something there.
Yeah, to argue the other side of the question, but from a different angle. Let's suppose the Russians are doing as badly as the mainstream media is saying. Does that mean that NATO is going to do better? Okay, and be able to defeat the Russians?
Right.
Let's not forget that the Ukrainian army was trained by the Russians. They used Russian tactics and strategy. All of their equipment is Russian equipment. Ukraine started the war anyway with 1,500 main battle tanks. You know, that's more main battle tanks than Germany, the United Kingdom, the Benelux countries, Germany, and Poland combined.
Mm.
So, you know, it wasn't like Ukraine was that much of a pushover compared to European NATO. You know, now they did have a vast inferiority when it came to the Air Force. This too would argue for great caution. You know, Ukraine is not a NATO-trained, NATO-armed nation. That if it is defeating the Russians, it's not because of the training they've gotten from the United States, as much as the Biden administration would like to propagandize to that effect. And it's not because they're armed with American and NATO-built equipment. You know, it's because they know how the Russians fight, and they have Russian equipment, and they've been trained by the Russians, and their general staff thinks like the Russians. And if they are doing as well, that's why. You know, so we shouldn't assume that our equipment and our NATO, European, German, and UK-trained forces, if they did go into Ukraine, would do as well as the Ukrainians. You know, but anyway, these are just some of the things I've thought about as to why, you know, we shouldn't assume that it's going to be a cakewalk if we get involved in a war with Ukraine. And don't forget that 10-to-1 superiority in tactical nuclear weapons. It's at least a 10-to-1 superiority. An analogy I would like to use to the audience, too. But I say we have no... Even if it were true that... I'll end with the analogy. Even if it were true that we had vital national interests at stake in Ukraine, I would still be against American intervention, because our most important interest would be put at risk, which is the survival of the United States and the American people. There is no interest in Ukraine, and we certainly have no vital interest there, but we have no interests that are so important that they would be worth risking the existence of this country. So what do we do about Ukraine? We should take Ukraine as an object lesson in what happens when the United States allows the strategic balance to tip against itself. This is, we're going to see a lot more of this, because The Biden administration is weak, and multiple administrations before the Biden administration have allowed us to become inferior in the most important part of the military balance, the nuclear part of the military balance. And that's what happens when you can put an aggressive umbrella over your activities. The defensive nature of the U.S. umbrella, it loses credibility, you know, when the other side has got these advantages. And they will start exploiting it. Russia will exploit it. China will commit acts of aggression. So will North Korea. So will Iran. We're going to see more of this. So we should, you know, use this as a lesson and avenge Ukraine by rebuilding American nuclear, military, and economic strength, so that we can prevail peacefully the way Ronald Reagan did during the Cold War. We won the Cold War exactly to that formula, peace through strength, by becoming so powerful that our adversaries, in the end, not only dared not start wars, but the internal contradictions of their dictatorships and tyrannical systems in the arms race against us ended up undermining their own societies, and they collapsed under the burden of the arms race. Ronald Reagan... Lindsey Chicken Hawks like Lindsey Graham forget. Ronald Reagan fought no major war. The only war he fought was the invasion of the little island of Grenada, you know? But he managed to win the Cold War decisively and made the Soviet Union go away peacefully, you know, because he built up our military strength. And that's what the lesson we should take from Ukraine. You know, the best of revenge for Ukraine will be for us to win the new Cold War peacefully.
Right.
Yeah, and get back our energy independence and all of those things.
That's all part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that we had. In addition to maybe they can wake up and smell the coffee and consider things about the grid, because we are in a much more vulnerable position than a lot of people realize. Anyone who's listened to you on a regular basis or read any of your books totally gets it, but I don't think the average person really gives that much thought.
Yeah, the average person, one interviewer kind of sprung this on me and said, look, what you're advocating, let's put it in human terms. It's as if you're saying that you're seeing a neighbor, call that neighbor Ukraine, being beat up by a burglar, and you're not going to come to that person's rescue. You know, isn't that shameful? How can the United States do that? Well, let's take that same analogy and make it a little more accurate, okay? Let's say there is a neighbor, and call it Ukraine, that's being beat up by a burglar who's armed with a machine gun,
yeah.
You know, a modern machine gun, okay? And you have a family to protect, and this guy knows where your family lives, and you are armed with a 22 caliber pistol that hasn't been tested, that you inherited from your grandfather, and hasn't been tested in 30 years.
And, yeah.
And
trigger
you know
finger
if you
has
go to this guy's rescue that you're going to have a gunfight, and it's almost certain that you're going to lose. And then this guy is going to go and kill your family.
Yeah.
What's the right moral thing to do under that circumstance?
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
I bet they enjoyed that answer.
Yeah.
Fellers, we got to leave her there. We can absolutely do this again, and I think we should, because it's important to counterbalance what's going on out there. There's a lot of stupidity being proffered on this particular topic. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is on the road, on the way to Florida. Have a terrific time. We will see you very soon. And you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I can't wait to get on the road again.
Places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the